Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode. In previous podcasts, you've heard me mention the Feminine Macabre, which is a journal highlighting the work of women and non-binary researchers in the paranormal field. In today's episode, I am lucky to be joined by not one, but two guests, both who feature in Volume 1 and Volume 2. We're going to be exploring their writing, their ideas and questions in some more depth. I'm really excited to get going with this one, so let's introduce them. Hi, Amy. Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's just fantastic to have you both here, especially given that you both have works not only in the first volume of The Feminine Macabre, but also the upcoming book, which is due out very, very soon. Amy, do you want to start off by just telling everyone who's listening a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm Amy Bennett. I'm based in upstate New York outside of Albany with my partner in crime, Ryan. And we're primarily investigators who, under normal circumstances, like to travel and usually go kind of far to find some strange places and see if we can just experience what we can for ourselves, not try to prove or make something of it that isn't, you know, something we experienced, and then create videos for it. So I guess you could say at our most base, we are YouTubers, just trying to go out and experience what's unexplained for ourselves and present it to people in a nice and watchable way.
Fantastic. And Chris, what about yourself? What would you like to share with everybody listening today?
Yeah, so I'm Chris. I'm the host of a podcast called Buried Secrets. And the podcast is about the paranormal, the occult, and weird and forgotten history. And I'm based in Queens, New York. So a lot of the research I do is centered around local history here in Queens and also New York City.
And I suppose a logical question to ask both of you is why, you know, you're both interested in the paranormal. You know, what is it that kind of brought you into this field initially in the first place?
I think my dad gave me the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark trilogy books way too young. And I watched the Poltergeist movies, another trilogy that terrorized me. But in those, I found that, like, just the curiosity to think maybe this stuff is real. And growing up in the 80s and 90s with the great horror movies that existed then, I was just overexposed to this stuff. And it's fascinating, I think. And then having history part of my family, something my dad and grandmother were involved in, it all just kind of tied together and became... It's just too intriguing not to pursue. So it's a lot of horror stuff from when I was a kid, to be honest.
I think that's part of all of our interest, to be honest, because let's be honest, there was kind of that period where there was just so much material, wasn't there, in terms of good films and TV shows about it to hook someone's interest. And so, yeah, I think there'll be many people out there who started in the same way. What about you, Chris? What was the first spark for you?
Yeah. So I've been interested in paranormal stuff ever since I was a kid. I'd say my family's pretty interested in ghost stories and history. And there's definitely stories of ghost sightings in my family. And one story I always think is funny about just me being interested in the paranormal at a young age is the first thing I ever used the internet for was researching like folklore and fairy lore and that sort of thing back when I was a kid in the 90s. So I remember we had like a dial-up internet connection. Mm-hmm. And I remember just finding all these very 90s websites with like fun animated graphics, et cetera, about folklore and fairies, paranormal stuff, ghosts, et cetera. And I remember printing out these websites and I made like a binder of all the like stuff I had found on the internet about this subject matter. And also I grew up in Texas and I knew people who were like very religious and believed in demons. And I had a friend who thought that demons were like attacking him and that sort of thing. So I always knew people who believed in the paranormal and had a lot of interesting things to say about the paranormal. And I think that definitely shaped my interest and made me feel like there was something that was maybe real when it came to the paranormal. And then also part of the reason why I moved to New York was because of my interest in the paranormal. I attended a college called Fordham University, which is a Jesuit school in the Bronx. And a big part of why I moved here was because I was so charmed by some of the ghost stories that I had heard about Fordham. And the school has a really collegiate Gothic vibe. It's very spooky. There's a cemetery on campus. Part of The Exorcist was filmed there in a dorm that I used to live in. So I think it's just something I've always been really interested in.
I think I would have been one of your friends because I can appreciate the binder and the things being organized and put in there that you found out and researched. You know, I certainly did something similar. So yeah, I think we would have
I'm sure we would have been friends. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just whatever it is that is the beginning point for most people that I kind of that I know that are interested, it tends to be something that is a really lifelong interest, because the more you kind of explore, the more you ask questions, it doesn't seem to stop. There's always more questions. There's always more to think about, always more places to go to and to research. And so it's a really interesting hobby, if you want to call it that, you know, something that you're interested in, because it just keeps expanding. It doesn't seem to get smaller. And I think what Amanda did with The Feminine Macabre kind of highlighted that, because suddenly more people with their voices were being exposed and highlighting the various things that they were doing and the interests and the topics that they had and, you know, some of the things that they were trying that maybe nobody really knew about. And so I think it was an incredibly amazing project. And one that I just hope keeps running and running, because I think it opens up to a larger audience and to see what it is that some people are doing that maybe we wouldn't necessarily know about, like I said. So, yeah, congratulations to both of you to make it in the first book and the second.
Thanks.
Very exciting. And I think for me, what was really interesting about your two pieces in particular was that they were both very different and reading them, they just sparked so many different questions. And in some cases, there were questions that I had reading one that seemed also there when I was reading the second piece. And so there were these connections and things that I was bringing to both of your pieces. And I think, Chris, when you wrote at the end of yours about how a lot of what we do is kind of trying to put together pieces from narrators that aren't necessarily accurate and history that gets distorted and things that aren't necessarily easy to piece together. You know, that really struck a chord with, you know, with also what Amy was writing when she was exploring how ghosts have been presented, how it changes and how women and female spirits fall into that and how the history has impacted and change some of those things, you know, how it can distort. And I suppose for me, coming away reading both of yours, there was that really interesting question of how do we approach paranormal investigating? You know, how do we go in and how should people go in order to be mindful of that? So it was a really, for me, it was just incredibly interesting reading the two side by side and seeing those comparisons and similarities, even though you both wrote about completely different things. So, Amy, starting with you, do you want to just kind of give a brief summary about what it was that you wrote about for the first book?
For sure. I ended up writing about why and how women become ghost stories based on colors, primarily of their dresses, and why historically we're looking at those stories and carrying them into the now when we investigate. And I think it's hard to articulate, but I think I came from a place of just asking a lot of whys. Well, why is there a woman in white at every cemetery, sometimes green or another color? Why do people repeat these stories over and over? And I think after investigating for a while and coming across so many of these women in a various color stories, I had to just put my thoughts to it, like, where does this come from? And how are we attributing, you know, human attributes to an archetype of a woman that may or may not have existed? And of course, with history, it's subjective. Some things we just don't have historically and factually accurate. So we're really just trying to interpret age-old stories and why we do that with women and why what that looks like from, I guess, a more objective point of view in the paranormal.
And it opened up that whole kind of question of why only women? You know, why is that something that we predominantly mm-hmm. see for women and the roles that were being attributed to them? You know, the stereotypes of the fallen woman, the innocent, the virginal, you know, all mm-hmm. of these very, not outdated, because in some cases these are stereotypes that still exist today. But,
yeah,
you know, why is it that those are the first thing that people associate with that spirit, with that story? You know, how is it that that came to be? And as I say, this one really kind of sparked an interest for me, because obviously being in the United Kingdom, you can't go more than, say, 10 miles from any different direction before you have a story about a woman in brown, a woman in white, a woman in green, yeah. And they are literally just everywhere. And it's not something you typically see being associated with male spirits. You get the occasional story, but just nothing in comparison in terms of the sheer volume.
Yeah, precisely.
And it's just so incredibly intriguing to kind of think about that and realize that, and realize that the types of stories associated with these particular hauntings do seem to fit a mold of, you know, these female spirits being someone that's lost something, had some kind of a tragedy.
Right, or seeking revenge or very angry, but it's always an yeah. emotion attributed to them for them, kind of based on what their life might have been like or one story told, you know?
Absolutely. And that seems to be the, like you were saying, the one story told. Very little else is actually known about that person yeah. other than the end point, what it is that happened to them that has then created this story that has then subsequently gone down the generations. And, you know, again, that's where I could see real kind of connections with what Chris was writing about how stories and history can change depending on the narrator. And, you know, I think we as people researching either the history, the paranormal, have a duty to try and unpick the folklore, the way things have been changed over time from the reality of really understanding the difference, because I think if not, we run the risk of really getting it wrong and missing an awful lot of what's happening there, and not just the history, but obviously what could be going on with the residual haunting, if there is something there at all.
Yeah, I agree completely. It takes away from, like, we get farther away from the original story the more we keep perpetuating things too. Yeah. So just to give that awareness of what it's like to think of that, these colors and between men and women in these stories, was just what was most important for me to try to convey.
And it kind of, I went down this other like little wormhole in my head, which is very typical. If you could see the copy of the Feminine Macabre, it's literally littered with post-its where I was writing questions and, you know, thoughts. That's just what I do.
Oh, that's fine.
And I went down this wormhole of, if we actually think about some of the things that were happening, particularly for women when it came to what happened to them post-death, it sparked that question of, well, is there a reason why some of these stories around their dress are what they are? You know, is it less to do with the characteristics applied to them based on, you know, the historical moral standards that were being put on that person? Or was there some element of truth? Because, you know, if we think about mourning practices and death practices, there were certain cultures and places where colours of funeral attire were actually very much used. So mm-hmm. sometimes people would be dressed in a certain colour when they were buried. Yeah. And, you know, that they were trying to make some kind of a statement about that person in their life, in death. And it just kind of sparked, well, is that part of it? Is there, you know, something else there to kind of dig deep into and try and understand? Are some of these sightings of colours actually true to maybe something else that was going on rather than the story that everybody knows? It was an interesting one.
That's good to think about. I like that.
Yeah. Like I said, it's just opened up all of these other questions for me about, well, is it this? Could it be this? And I think it would be a really interesting area of research to see, you know, what other people think about it. I keep meaning to speak to someone else who came on one of my podcasts before who has a PhD in morning practices and, you know, spiritualism and so on. And she's actually featuring in the second book. And I keep meaning to ask her about it because genuinely it was a question that just I can't put to bed, because for me, I want to be able to separate from the stories to try and maybe get to why these colours, why these things being associated, to kind of understand it more, really.
Yeah, give it a broader picture.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as I say, Chris, in terms of your piece, I had the same kinds of questions in terms of, you could see that real interest in trying to get to the truth of the history and what was happening. And, you know, it really resonated when you were writing about the shipwrecks and your questioning about, well, why isn't there more? Why don't you experience more? Why isn't there more evidence of hauntings along this stretch based on the sheer number of people who have lost their lives in those accidents? You would expect more based on those kind of preconceived notions that should have something come through really strongly. Right. And I could see that real overlap. So, Chris, do you want to kind of give people a brief summary of your contribution in the first book?
Yeah, so I wrote about the history of the Hell Gate, which is a part of the East River that's very close to where I live. I live in a neighborhood called Astoria, which is in Western Queens, and it's right on the waterfront by, you know, like that looks across the East River towards Manhattan. And that waterfront is the Hell Gate. And it, one, has the name the Hell Gate, which is a pretty ominous name. And, you know, there are a lot of different places around the world that have the name hell or devil, etc., in them. And it often means that there's something dangerous about that place. And the Hell Gate was full of like reefs and rocks and all sorts of really treacherous, dangerous objects that ships would run into all the time. And also it's a tidal strait. So there's three different bodies of water kind of all merging there. So still today, I'll go to the waterfront and watch whirlpools like form in front of me and then kind of like fade away. So it's still somewhat dangerous, though. Back 100 or so years ago, they did, I guess more than 100 years ago, back in the, I think, late 19th century, they did like explode parts of the Hell Gate to try to clear it out a little bit and make it a little safer. But during the Revolutionary War, there was a ship called the Hussar that was a British ship that was carrying supposedly a bunch of gold that was payroll for the British soldiers. And that ran aground and sank in the Hell Gate. So there's been a lot of tales of treasure hunters trying to find that ship. There was also, in the early 20th century, there was a really tragic story about a ship that was carrying a church group to a picnic that caught fire and then ended up running aground in the Hell Gate. And over 1,000 people died in that disaster. It was the greatest loss of life in New York City until 9/11. And so there's these really, you know, upsetting and traumatic things that have happened in the Hell Gate. And it's known for being haunted. There's a story about a ghost train stopping at the Hell Gate Bridge, which is a bridge that goes right over the Hell Gate that the Amtrak goes over. There's stories about a ghost train, but they're pretty vague and just sound like urban legends. And there's also an old urban legend from the 70s and 80s about a serial killer supposedly living in that bridge. And to me, like you said, like to me, those ghost stories feel kind of anemic and made up and don't seem to have much to do with what happened there. It's almost like people just picked up that there was something creepy about that spot. And because of you know, whatever preoccupations society had at that time. You know, I feel like the 70s and 80s with horror movies and stuff, I feel like the idea of this creepy serial killer living in a bridge would be something that someone would kind of like make up. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely been a little maddening to me just like looking for stories and just not finding the types of hauntings that I would expect to see there.
Yeah.
So yeah, just a really interesting part of New York City that both has lots of stories, but also it feels like there's some stuff missing from that area.
Yeah, the myths, and again, just trying to wade through the stories, the reality, mm-hmm. the history, what's true, what's not true. And I think you raise something really interesting that, again, I think has echoes and resonates with both your pieces, which was that, you know, what is it that was influencing some of the stories that maybe were embellishing the truth and mm-hmm. Enhancing the stories and the reality of what actually was going on. And, you know, for you, you hit, you know, when you're saying about the stories of things that you see coming out in the 70s and the 80s and how that impacts on maybe the, what we understand today in terms of how that might have evolved and enhanced the original nub of the truth into something else. But, you know, I think the same is true for much, you know, if we're thinking hundreds of years back, when a lot of these stories around these, you know, these women in their white dresses and their brown dresses and everything else, if we think about the history of those, of that period, you know, with the fear of death and what happened in the afterlife with science clashing with spirituality and religion, and, you know, people just genuinely fearing the afterlife because of that. And obviously tied up into all of that, the religious expectations, the moral expectations of whether you deserved to go into heaven or not, you know, how maybe all of that sparked all of these stories that may have kind of been exaggerated to highlight something about their character. And again, just stripping all those layers back to understand the real person behind it would allow us, I think, to go in with a much more open mind to actually see for ourselves and just gather the evidence and see if there is anything there or not. And, you know, we might be surprised as to what actually comes out, if anything at all. You know, just like your experience in this particular location where you expect something very different to what you actually pick up and get.
Right. Yeah, I lately have been feeling very almost like frustrated and demoralized researching ghost stories in this area, because so many of them either, like, you know, when you're reading old newspaper accounts, they either seem kind of like vague and made up, and maybe they're just, you know, to sell newspapers, or you read accounts that feel like they're focused on like almost like the wrong people. Mm-hmm. Like the people who history remembers are often the people who get to have ghost stories about them, which feels so unfair to me. There's a woman in white story right near here in Astoria about, you know, different people on this one street in Astoria have seen this lady in white. And the theory is that it's, I believe, Elizabeth Hallett, who was this woman who was an enslaver, like her family owned human beings. And so she kind of gets to have this romantic story about her where she's like, oh, she's this woman in white, etc. But so much, but it's like, well, what about the people who she enslaved? Like, where are their stories? Like, they've been written out of history, and it feels so unfair that it's their stories are like written out of even like the myths and legends that are here.
Yep.
And if they are there, it's a watered down version of it that someone else wants to tell.
Exactly.
That's also the striking bit. It's again, it's just getting to the truth. And, you know, let's be honest, not all hauntings are because of tragedy and because of all of these things. You know, we could have something really beautiful and happy, and that be the bit that, you know, someone might tap into the energy of that moment playing out in a location and a place. It doesn't have to be doom and gloom. And I think we have to move away from the way that the, you know, ghosts, spirits, hauntings kind of progressed from it being one thing to always something truly tragic, devastating, and, you know, it being something fearful. It doesn't have to be that at all. And that can be then just any person, you know, how many people experience going into a location, just seeing spirits and residual hauntings of people literally going about their everyday lives, you know, right. just standing in their homes, nothing more sinister than their presence, just there, just like they always were in the past. As I say, just moving away from what people think it should be to let's actually get to the reality of what it often is. I think it's really important. So I guess my question for both of you then is, what do you see as being the really important thing that someone going into paranormal investigating or research should really try and be mindful of when obviously looking at a particular location or the history or going into the location itself to ask questions, to try and investigate with, you know, whatever it is that they're taking in to help them to do that? What would you say they should try and do or try and avoid to make it more, you know, a more authentic investigation?
I think I would convey the thing that I wish I had known like a decade ago is a sense of awareness that the paranormal is made mostly by people. And people, I mean, we're not the most reliable witnesses. We can't even see in the dark. So we're telling stories and we're trying to base our experiences off these other stories, old stories, newer stories. And to be aware that the paranormal that you search for is really, at least for me anyway, it's really going to end up being just personal. Like as much as you try to prove something to anyone, someone in particular, you're mostly going to walk away with experiences for yourself. And while that sounds selfish, I think that's just the reality of how folklore and the paranormal and mythology work. We can't prove it, so we have to experience it for ourselves. So investigate for sure. Be curious for sure. But know that the only time you're going to find answers is going to be within yourself. And they're very difficult to convey to the public at large.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, what about sure. you, Chris? What would you kind of say to someone else to consider and to think about if they were going into this?
Yeah, so I think for me, and I'm definitely like more focused on research than investigation. So I guess my answer is more geared towards that. But for me, so much of doing research is kind of like being willing to not have a clear answer and kind of like often the deeper you go into things and the more you research things, the more interesting things get, but also the more complex
yep.
and the more frustrating and kind of just like you have to be able to be at peace with just knowing that you might not find a clear cut and dry story. I think we've been primed by fiction into, you know, we want to have like a clear story with a beginning, a middle and an end and, mm-hmm. you know, some kind of exciting structure for any kind of like even history we're trying to research. And I think so often it's like you end up leaving with more questions than answers and you just have to be okay with that. And for me, definitely like if I hear something that's too definitive, then I start to doubt it. And I'm like, that seems like too pat, too cut and dry. Probably there's something wrong with this account, et cetera. Mm. That's been a big thing I feel like I've grappled with while doing research.
I think those are both very important things to kind of take on board and very relevant, actually. I would agree with both of those. So obviously we've got the exciting next installment to look forward to, hopefully coming out in the next few weeks. I actually heard from Amanda a while ago as to what you both were doing. So I feel like I got spoilers early. But don't tell anyone else. But yes, I'm really looking forward to what you're both going to be producing in the next installment. And I guess what I'd like to do is talk about those if we can. I know, Amy, you're looking at women in insane asylums, aren't you? And that's something that you've always been really interested in. And I guess given the topic from the first book with women, colourful women, it kind of makes sense because you're again highlighting that aspect of their treatment and how they were often very wrongly institutionalised, and then the stories obviously that get perpetuated and the expectations based on that when people go in and investigate is, I guess, where you're heading. But please enlighten me. I'd love to know what it is that you've kind of been thinking about for this upcoming next section?
Yeah, for sure. I guess I kind of wanted to give the women that I was talking about a little more concrete context. And Chris, your piece, including Nellie Bly, one of my favorite journalists, I kept her spirit alive a little bit and threw, because I love Nellie's work, and so I threw in some quotes by her to give that context, because she's this investigative journalist from over 100 years ago who went to Roosevelt Island and Blackwell's Asylum and wrote about it while being in it undercover. And so for us to look at, like, for female investigators anyway, to look at these places, these now former asylums, dotting across the country, mostly in the East, where they're terrifying looking, and want to go to them. I kind of wanted to give the context of why are we as female identifying or female investigators pulled to these places? What more is there to it? And is it more psychological than paranormal? Or is there something more paranormal than psychological? But you're going to have to read it to get to where I got to the bottom of that. But giving these women with these stereotypes a little more context in a particular situation and asylums, I mean, that's such a huge part of American and European Western history and how women have been treated over time and how it pertains to our ghost stories now.
Absolutely. And Chris, you're writing about Ouija mania, aren't you? So yeah. Again, something very different as a topic.
Different, but also I feel like there might be some overlap in our pieces. I'm so excited to read yours, Amy. It sounds awesome.
Thank you. You too.
Yeah. So last year I did a series on my podcast about the history of Ouija boards. And when I was searching through these old newspaper archives, I found a ton of articles from the 1920s, but especially a ton of articles from 1920, like a stunning amount. You know, I was going through like thousands of articles and just I was floored by the number of articles from 1920 about Ouija boards. And it makes sense, right? 1920 was just after World War I and the Spanish flu. It makes sense that spirit communication and Ouija boards had a big surge in popularity. And interestingly, a lot of these articles from 1920 were about this phenomenon called Ouija mania, which was this idea that women were being driven insane by Ouija board use. And one thing that I noticed was that a lot of the language that was used in these articles in discussing Ouija mania was that a lot of that language was also used in the eugenics movement in the United States, which was very popular at the time. And people think of the 1920s as being this fun, carefree time with prohibition and flappers and such, but it was a pretty dark time in the US. A lot of dark stuff was brewing. The KKK was on the rise, white supremacy was on the rise, and the eugenics movement was just, you know, in full force. And of course, later the Nazis would base many of their own evil programs on the US eugenics program. So it was really strange to me to be reading these articles and to see them use terminology that was used in the eugenics movement to describe these women. And then of course, you know, and there were actually medical professionals who were being quoted in newspaper articles about these women supposedly being driven insane by Ouija board use. And a lot of women were institutionalized for this. And I talked about one particularly dramatic case in El Cerrito, California, where there was a group of women who ended up being institutionalized. And it had a lot of like a satanic panic vibe. Like it really reminded me of that moral panic back in the 80s. And, you know, a lot of these, you know, all these women were institutionalized, and several of them were institutionalized in an institution that sterilized people as part of their, quote, treatment. So the piece looks a lot at, you know, this weird kind of manufactured moral panic about Ouija mania, but also like the very real and terrifying and evil eugenics movement that's kind of linked up with that. So it's interesting. I feel like, Amy, you and I are like both kind of looking at women in being institutionalized and having, getting very bad mental health treatment back in the day.
Yeah, the same problem, but from very different angles, but still coming at it in, you know, with the same thinking and thought process in mind. Yeah, absolutely. Right. And you know, Ouija boards still have that bad rep, don't they, in terms of mm-hmm. the hype around them. And if we think about modern films and the portrayal that they have, they really do get a bad reputation
right.
for just a communication device that has been used for a very long time now. I mean, this is one of the few types of techniques that have carried over from, you know, early spiritualism. So
right.
it's fascinating the kinds of thoughts that people have about them. And you can understand when along the way it's had the kind of criticism and these things happen, like I think you're going to write about in this piece, of, you know, just this panic and fear and fear-mongering around them to help push other agendas, I think.
Right. And a lot of it was definitely obviously manufactured. There was a book that was written, off the top of my head, I think it was called The New Black Magic and the Truth About the Ouija Board, something like that. But the man who wrote it was actually supposedly basically commissioned by the Catholic Church to write this book about how Ouija was evil.
Mm.
And, you know, so like at the time, institutions were like, okay, we don't like this and we don't like women. How can we, you know, kill two birds with one stone here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in terms of a spirit board, talking board, Ouija board, whichever you call it, is that something that you've ever used on investigations, Amy, given that, you know, you do go into buildings as an investigator? Is it something that you shy away from, or are you quite happy to use?
I am always quite happy to use it. I wish we could, that Ryan and I could say we have these crazy Ouija stories or we've seen or felt something. Ryan has a little more of a spiritual past than me and has some funky stories, but the way we look at it, I mean, it's demonized and weaponized through media, like movies and TVs, of course. But because of so much media now, with people making videos and podcasts and reels and all the media we have, we've kind of, I think it's never really lost its popularity. It's just gone through kind of like these fluid moments of popularity or unpopularity. And we saw it, you know, really hurt people in the 80s into the 90s a little there. And then it kind of fell away until all the movies from the 70s and 80s became cult classics. And now the thing is back, and finding them is, of course, fun. And yeah, there's like five in our house right now, so I'm not scared or anything. They're, because we start to think, you know, what's the difference between a Ouija board and a digital recorder?
Yeah.
Well, our intent is the same, isn't it?
Exactly. You know? And, you know, I think, like so many things, it can lose the original purpose of what it was. It becomes something completely different. And when you just think of it as a simple means of communication where you are calling out an answer, it's no different to any other device where you're doing the same. But yeah, I think all these different avenues, books, media, television, films, they've all played that part in creating certainly a myth about it in terms of what it is and how it's used and what it can kind of bring about. And it's just not the case. I mean, the number of ghost investigations I've been on where that's been the butt of the joke at the beginning, you know, where you can take this kind of spirit with you and all the rest of it, just as a means of poking fun at it. But it's kind of sad that that has to be the case, that unfortunately these things do happen. And it's just about how things get embellished, and it becomes then the next person embellishing a little bit more, and suddenly you've got something completely different, like I said, to the original purpose. I have no issues with using them. I think for me, the main thing I would say is I've had very little, you know, evidence from them at all. So I wouldn't avoid them, but certainly nothing like you kind of see portrayed.
No, the movies are powerful. They really know how to CGI that up and scare people. Like, I'm waiting for the day a planchette rolls across the board itself, but it's like, it's a tool, but it's also really not one of my favorites, because it certainly doesn't leave me with a lot of paranormal or unexplainable experiences at the end of the day. It leaves me with a half hour I really tried and my arms fell asleep more often than not.
But that's where I think, you know, how they're portrayed can be really quite damaging, because if people go in with an expectations of it, you know, the planchette really is going to be moving all around the board and it's going to be doing this and that and it's going to go wild, people often then feel very let down. And obviously so much of what we experience is when we have that open mind and not what we think is going to happen. You know, we're open to anything and just being realistic and keeping that positivity and that energy, because I do think how we behave plays a really important part as to whether things come through or not. And so I think, you know, those overhyped expectations can actually be very detrimental if that's what people are expecting when using that particular piece of equipment, which is, as I say, just unfortunate. I wish it didn't have the reputation that it does, but I don't think it's going away in a hurry, unfortunately. So in terms of the question about why these particular topics came up and why these are interesting subjects for you both in terms of the first book, the second book, is this something that you kind of keep exploring and you keep wondering and you keep investigating and researching? Are these just like lifelong interesting topics that just has your mind connecting these dots and asking these questions, like you were talking about earlier, I guess, Chris, about why they're intriguing and what intrigues you to keep going? Are these the things that have really sparked your interest?
I feel like for me, maybe not the specific topics, like Ouija itself, I didn't get super interested in until last year when I like got really fascinated with the history and did a really deep dive. But definitely like for the essay that I did for volume one about kind of like this local history and the Hellgate, that definitely has been a lifelong interest for me, like looking for the strange things in the place where I live, and kind of like trying to like almost re-enchant the world, right? Like, I feel like daily life can be so kind of monotonous and boring. And it's so nice to be able to like go for a run and look across the river and like look at Roosevelt Island and see the old, atrium of the New York Lunatic Asylum, which is now an extremely fancy apartment building, and like know that I know this whole history about it. I really like that. And also it feels like you're always on like almost like a treasure hunt or something. Like you're like, what am I going to find out about this place that maybe like I pass all the time or I think about just as part of my daily life? Like, what new thing am I going to find out about that? I think that's something I get really excited about.
I think it's beautiful and inspiring. And I've said it before, I wish there was more done like that within, you know, our communities to highlight the local history, to really keep those stories alive and the truth alive, because so often those little things, those little details can then just get lost in time. And that shouldn't happen. We should see the story attached to that building or that particular spot and understand what happened there, because they're just incredibly powerful moments. And however big or small they were, they're still powerful and important moments and the people linked to them. So I think I completely understand why that's your passion, and I completely endorse that love of trying to share that with other people and to inspire other people to do the same, because I think it just opens up your environment in a completely different way, which is just magical. So completely on board with that one. What about you, Amy? Was this something that was just has always been an interest, or is it just something that you've been focusing on right now?
I think the more I've investigated, the more I've come to be interested in why we tell the stories that we tell over and over. And then seeing the patterns, at least for women in different colors. And of course, I was going to add to the original article about how men are usually men in black. Yeah. And the very hyper-masculine presentation of men in the paranormal is foreboding and very obvious as well. But I wanted to like look at that, because we're going to all these places, we're trying to go to the bigger places. Well, now we're hoping to go to the bigger places safely. And a lot of them are asylums, and a lot of those places had women that were just absolutely not supposed to be anywhere near that place. But when we try to examine the paranormal through like a lens of how society and culture reflected its own fears and normalcies back, we see these patterns. So it became more and more intriguing to keep going down this rabbit hole. And I don't think I'm done, because like you said, it's just there's such a huge umbrella of history in all these different places through, you know, centuries of time. And they all kind of link together, and the umbrella of the paranormal is huge enough to be endless and cover so much of that.
And keep so many people interested it, because there's so many different parts of it you can look at and moments to focus on or questions to focus on. So, you know, that's a beautiful way of kind of explaining it as this very big umbrella with all these over kind of overarching ideas and themes and questions that, you know, can just bring and lure people in. And I really do hope, I really do hope that both of you continue, because certainly I enjoyed both of your pieces. And Chris, I love your podcast. So
thank you.
You know, exploring these questions and what it is that you both do and what you enjoy focusing on is something that I continue to hope to enjoy. And I hope so many other people continue to do the same, because, like I said, being able to keep asking those questions and be interested by it is what's special and magical about the history and the paranormal that I think has so many of us fascinated. So thank you for being a part of that. And, you know, again, well done to Amanda. Hats off for being able
for
to
sure.
pull it together a second time.
Yeah.
So thank you. And for being here today. It has been truly, truly magical. I hope that I get hold of the book very, very shortly, and I'm able to enjoy it as much as I did the first one.
Yeah, us too. I can't wait to see it. I'm not going to research Ouija Mania until the second volume comes out.
I know.
I'm gonna let that be the introduction. I'm excited.
Well, thank you so much for both of your time. I really, truly, truly appreciate it. So I will say goodbye for now. Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
If you have liked this podcast, then there are a number of things that you can do. Come along and follow Haunted History Chronicles on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The links are below in the description to this podcast. Share news of the podcast with friends, family who may be interested. You can also come along and join us on our new website, which has a plethora of other features, including information on our episodes, guests, and a blog which includes guest writers. You can support the podcast further by leaving us a review or taking a look at our Patreon page, and in the process gain access to some extra goodies. Your support and encouragement is always invaluable. Thank you so very much, everyone.